Now, yesterday I had the privilege of attending the funeral of Jack Edwards. Family and friends, of course, gathered together to celebrate his life and his graduation into the next life. And at this service, pastors and several family members, they took the opportunity to reminisce about Jack, and particularly about his character. His obituary remarks, "He was a hard-working family man that loved the Lord. He did his best to instill those same values into his children." Now, we talk a lot on Sunday mornings about character, right? Particularly about the character of God. And we understand that people, that individuals, persons, we have a character. But what about families? Do families have a character? Jack did his best to instill those same values in his children. I was around a lot of Edwards yesterday. All right, there's a lot from that line here today. Okay? What did I say? Do families have a character? Was Jack successful? I'd say he was. He was certainly. I mean, if you haven't spent a lot of time with some Edwards, I bet if you just start to peruse around this little room today, I bet you can guess pretty quick who's related to who on Jack's side of the family. Families have a character. My wife's family is that way. You come and visit the Thomasons on Thanksgiving, you'll see they have a character. Everyone's family's that way. They have a character. But what about something a little bit larger, a larger group of people? What about cities? Do cities have a character? Does Austin, Texas have a character? Keep it weird. Dallas, Houston, cities have a character. States, do states have a character? Texas, New York, California, we think of very different things. Do regions have a character? North, South, East Coast, West Coast. What about nations? Do nations have a character? What do you think of when you think about Canada, eh? Right? They're these neutral guys to the north. We don't really know what they're doing. They don't really know what they're doing. They're friendly people, but they're really not messing with anybody. They're kind of doing their own thing up there. What's the character of the United States? Maybe some mixed opinions on that one. Today we're going to talk about the character of a nation. Our text is going to address the character of a nation, and we're going to be in the book of Obadiah. So if you want to start traveling to the book of Obadiah, you'll find it in the Minor Prophets, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah. So if you're in Jonah, you've gone too far, go back. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. It's the shortest book in the Old Testament. If your pages get stuck together, you'll miss it. It's only 21 verses long, so we won't spend more than 21 weeks in it. Ron's over there giving me sideways eyes. I see you, Ron. No, it's the shortest book in the Old Testament. I can't say it's short and sweet. It's a spicy book. We don't know when it was written. It's sometime after some kind of an attack on Jerusalem. I personally think it's after the Babylonian invasion that we just covered at the end of 2 Kings. Okay, I think that's where we're at, but maybe not. We don't know anything about the author, Obadiah. There's 12 of them in Scripture. The name Obadiah just means servant of Yahweh, so it could very well be a title and not a name. I like to think that it's Jeremiah. I think that he may have written Lamentations, and I like to think that he wrote Obadiah as well, and that was kind of his pen name, was Obadiah. So, we really don't know though, and it's really not important to the message, as we'll find. Let's pick it up, if you've made it there, Obadiah, chapter 1, verse 1. The vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and an envoy has been sent among the nations, saying, "Arise, let us go against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised." The author says, we've got a message from the boss. And it's for Edom. Okay? Now, that's an interesting way to begin an oracle in the Hebrew Bible. We would expect that the prophecies in Israel's Bible to be addressed to Israel. Right? They may say some things about the nations, but it's in their Bible. I'm thinking this is a letter to them. That's not the case here. This one's for Edom, and they're in trouble. And we're going to find that the prophets in this particular case and throughout some other prophets, they're going to deal with the nations like people. How do nations get in trouble with God? How do people get in trouble with God? Our fundamental problem is a character problem. It's been an issue since Genesis 3, and since what is true in this particular respect on the small scale with individuals happens to be true on the large scale with nations, we're going to simplify this whole thing by viewing the nations as people. We're going to think of them like kids on a playground, because that's how they're going to act. Now, there's some things that teachers generally know about the kids that are going to be in their class. They have an idea of what to expect from these kids based on a few things. They know what families the kids come from, right? They know if they have any siblings, any that are around that have been through. They know if they've caused any problems for teachers in the past. Do we know what family Edom came from? We do. They are descendants of Abraham. Oh. Do they have any siblings? They do. They actually have a twin brother that's hanging around. His name is Israel. You may remember, I'll turn there, you can if you want, Genesis chapter 25. At the beginning of the nation of Israel. Genesis chapter 25, listen to it as I read it. I'm going to start in verse 19. Now these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, this is Genesis 25, the Aramean to be his wife, verse 21. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If this is so, then why am I this way?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body. The one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red all over, like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. Afterwards, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to him. Okay, so we have two nations in Rebekah's womb. They come forth named Esau and Jacob. Later, their names are going to be changed. Edom and Israel. Edom had to do with Isaac despising that birthright. Okay, he traded it for a red piece of stew, so his name was made Red. Edom. And of course, Jacob wrestled with God, and his name was changed to Israel. Wrestles with God. Okay, so two nations, two peoples. And that's, turn back to Obadiah, that's who we're dealing with. Do they have any other family that we're going to come across in the story? They got a couple second cousins running around. Moab and Ammon. You may recall Lot. Lot had a couple children by his daughters, Moab and Ammon. They're not going to pop up in Obadiah, but they're going to be causing trouble in other books. So this family has some issues we're going to find. Now, look at verse 3 of Obadiah. What is the character of Edom like? Well, the arrogance of your heart has deceived you. You who live in the clefts of the rock, in the loftiness of your dwelling place, who say in your heart, "Who will bring me down to earth?" Though you build high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves came to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you will be ruined. Would they not steal until they had enough? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave just some gleanings? Oh, how Esau will be ransacked and his treasures searched out. Edom is an arrogant little twerp. Okay? He's got a pride issue. And there's something that we got to understand about pride when we're talking about the sin of pride. Pride is a relative assessment that we make. Okay? It is driven by something else. That's not what's in the driver's seat. There's an engine in the background. And the engine is what the biblical authors will call the sin. That's what Paul will call it in Romans 5. Most of our translations don't have it there, but the article, the, is there. He's talking about one particular sin, the sin. It is the sin of Adam. It is the sin of Satan. Okay, it's that number one problem. Now, if we think we are superior to someone in our relative assessment, I'm proud. What about if I think I'm inferior to someone in my relative subjective assessment? Then I'm envious. Pride, envy. Okay? Different spectrums being driven by that same engine. And we're going to find that Edom is measuring himself against who? His brother. He's measuring himself against his brother. Now, before Jacob and Esau was born, it was prophesied in that verse we just read, the older will serve the younger. Who's the older?
Esau.
Edom's the older brother. The Edomites are the older brothers of the Israelites. And yet the older will serve the younger. That's a tough pill to swallow. That's not our natural estimations of how things ought to be. He's the oldest, yet the younger brother is favored. Even his parents had issues with that. Isaac had a hard time with it. He didn't want to let it go. But the older will serve the younger. And as you remember, this story plays out with Jacob taking Esau's birthright, first of all, his right to the land. And then later on, he takes his blessing. Now, we say it's his. The Lord already said it was going to be Jacob's. But he takes both of them. Esau wants to kill him. He runs off to Uncle Laban. Years later down the road, we find him making his way back. He's wore out his welcome over there too. He's not a very likable fellow. He's making his way back. This is where he wrestles with God. He has to end up, though, crossing paths with his older brother once again. His older brother coming with a whole group of men. He says, this is a problem. Because I didn't leave things really good back home either. He was trying to kill me. So he's expecting problems. So what he does is Jacob starts sending all kinds of gifts to his brother to try to appease him, to try to, you know, smooth things over. When he gets to his brother, Esau says, look, I don't need these gifts. Let's be reconciled. You come and live with me in my land. Jacob says, okay, but you go on ahead. Okay, I got, the flocks are too tired, they'll get worn out. And he says, let me leave some people with you. No, you go on ahead, I will catch up. Okay, so Esau leaves, and you know what Jacob then does? He goes the opposite direction. He lied to his brother. He lied to him. So here's Esau, thinking everything's repaired, and come to find out, this little brother of his doesn't want to have anything to do with him. He's trying to care for his brother, again, be the older brother. Jacob could have just said, look, I've just talked with the Lord. I appreciate that, brother. I love you. I'm glad things are good. I got to go deal with this land over here. But he doesn't do that. Okay? He's afraid, and instead he lies. You think that was a problem for Esau? You think it affected him? Turn here. I want you to just look. Keep a finger in Obadiah. Don't lose this little book. But just turn to Numbers chapter 20 for just a moment. I just want you to see one thing. Numbers chapter 20. Or flip there on your phone. Numbers chapter 20. When you get there, look down to verse 14. Now this is a time when Israel has just been led by Moses on their exodus. They're trying to make it to the promised land. Numbers chapter 20, verse 14. From Kadesh, Moses sent messengers to the king of Edom. Thus your brother Israel has said, you know all the hardship that's befallen us, that our fathers went down to Egypt and we stayed in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, He heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out of Egypt. Now behold, we're at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through field or through vineyard. We'll not even drink water from a well. We'll just go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or left, until we pass through your territory. Verse 18, Edom, however, said to him, you shall not pass through us, or I will come out with the sword against you. Again, the sons of Israel said to him, we'll go up by the highway, and if I and my livestock do drink any of your water, then I'll pay its price. Let me only pass through on my feet, nothing else. But he said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory. So Israel turned away from him. You can go back to Obadiah. It's been 400 years, and Edom is still bitter. Okay? It's been passed down from generation to generation to generation. Okay? Remember Esau, he married Canaanites. The parents didn't like the son, didn't like the women he married. They're all bitter. Do we see this kind of bitterness passed down from generation to generation today? Do Muslims still have issues with the Crusades? It's been like 1,000 years. In our own country, we have some very serious racial issues. Much more recent, but nonetheless, I don't know anyone that were slaves. But this difficulty, this hardship that's happened between our peoples has caused resentment and hostility and bitterness that is passed on. Passed on from generation to generation. Now, in our text, in Obadiah, Edom's still sitting in the same spot. Okay, he was in that spot. He said, come stay in my land. Jacob said, no. Jacob ends up in Israel. In Egypt. Israel ends up in Egypt. They're on their way out, try to pass through that same land. They said, you didn't want to come with us then. You're not coming through it now then. All the way back to the book of Obadiah, many years later, they're still in that same plot of land. And it's a difficult spot to get to. Okay? They live in the clefts of the rock, the author will say. Militarily, they're very well defended. Okay? They're surrounded by these high mountains. The entrances to their cities are narrow passages through the clefts of the rock. Any of you guys seen Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade? Some? If you haven't, watch it. But all the same, at the very end, when you see Indiana Jones riding out, he's leaving this building that's been carved into a rock, and they're riding on a horse through these very narrow passageways. It's in Petra. Petra is where Edom was. This is Edom's territory. That's what it's like. It's very well defended. So I don't care if you got a million guys, huge army isn't so bad when they got to march single file through your territory. Okay? These narrow passages make it very well defended. Edom's the kid on the playground who's like, it's like he's sitting on the jungle gym. And he thinks that his security and his well-being comes from his own strength, from his own brilliance. The same passage here, verses 1 through 6 is repeated in Jeremiah 49 with a few additions. That's one of the reasons I think Jeremiah might have a hand in it. With a few additions, though. He says, okay, Edom, yeah, you build your buildings, your cities high in the clefts of the rock. You build like an eagle. You put your nest high like an eagle. But guess what? God's going to swoop down on your head like an eagle. He's going to bring you down. You can build as high as you want. God can bring you down. And I say, why? Why is God coming against Edom? Why this nation? I can think of other nations that are pretty proud of their defense, that are pretty proud of their brilliance, that are pretty proud of their military. Bigger nations than Edom. I can even think of nations today in the U.S. We've got two oceans beside us. Nobody can touch us. We've got the best military in the world. We've got the smartest people in the world. Our CIA is amazing. And I say, can God bring me down if He wants to? If God wants to touch us, He can touch us. So I want to find out, why is God touching Edom? Because I don't want that. What are the rules that Edom is expected to follow as a nation? And why? Are they expected to follow the same rules as Israel? Their brother? Is Edom under the Mosaic Covenant? No. See, his brother is. Israel is under the Mosaic Covenant. Edom is not. And that's why we don't see this text riddled with condemnations from Deuteronomy. You remember going through Lamentations? I gave you all that sheet that had 20 of them, but there's a ton more. And they're just saying, you broke it up. Why are we in exile? Oh, well, let me remind you. We broke this. So these terrible things are happening to us. We don't see that in here. Is Edom responsible to any other covenants, though, I ask? If they're not responsible to the Mosaic covenant, what about the Abrahamic covenant? I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. This is the plot of land you're going to get. From here, you're going to rule the other nations and represent me. Are they responsible to the Abrahamic covenant? Was Edom aware of the Abrahamic covenant? Oh, you've got to say that they are. Why was his name changed to Edom? He despised his birthright. He despised the land. And the blessing, of course, is tied to the land, so of course they both go together. He despised that. He traded it for a cup of red stew, so his name is changed to Edom. And the people's name now are not the Esauites, it is the Edomites. And they go, and you got to love the irony of God, they go live in this red place. It's called the Red Rose Place. It's this red sandstone. Like, everything is red now dealing with Edom. So everywhere you look, you come out and you see red. And you remember that red lentil stew that your great forefather traded y'all's birthright for. Now Israel's the one that's God's representative, not you. You're serving your younger brother. Yeah, they knew about the Abrahamic covenant. And they're responsible. They're responsible. So look at this. Verse 10. Just the first half. Why is this happening? Why is God coming against Edom? Because of the violence to your brother Jacob. Edom's sitting on the jungle gym. And he sees the nations come around and they start bullying up on his little brother. Now, what are older brothers supposed to do in these situations? How has God created older brothers? They're supposed to protect their siblings, right? Older sisters too. Older siblings protect the younger siblings. They care for them. What does Edom do? Well, he sees his younger brother getting beat up by the nations. And at first, notice, he doesn't do anything. Verse 11. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, you too were as one of them. He sits there and says, I'm going to watch how this plays out. Not my problem. Not my problem. But then, notice it, verse 12. Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. He begins to gloat now. Okay, he sees it. He says, well, I told you that birthright wasn't all it was cracked up to be. See, you had a chance. You could have come and stayed with me in the clefts of the rock. You could have come and got up on this jungle gym. You wouldn't have those problems. See, I can take care of myself up here. But you can't take care of yourself. And then he begins to rejoice. He's getting excited that his little brother is getting attacked. And then he begins to boast. I mean, after all, I was always able to take care of myself. You were always a mama's boy. Mama's not here now. You got problems. But that's not all. Verse 13. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Yes, you. Do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster. And do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster. See, now Edom begins to participate. He cheers the nations on, and then he joins in taking his little brother's stuff. I mean, it was his to begin with, right? It's mine to begin with. I'm just taking it back. You took it from me. Now it's come full circle. How about that? And finally, verse 14. Do not stand at the fork of the road to cut down their fugitives, and do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. Now he takes advantage of his battered brother. Now that he's been whooped and beat up, he can go and pick on him too. He can go and abuse him too. And the Lord is watching this play out. And even though the attack on Jerusalem is judgment for their sin, okay, this is the day of their misfortune, the day of their destruction, the day of their distress, the day of. Even though this judgment is from God, he sees what Edom is doing and he says, that ain't right. That ain't right. And he tells Edom, don't gloat over your brother's day. Don't rejoice over their day. Don't boast over their day. Why? Verse 15. For the day of the Lord draws near on all nations. Your day is coming too. Now, the author actually does something very interesting here in verse 15. In the original Hebrew, there are no vowel markers. Okay, all you got is consonants to work with, right? Say, well, that sounds like a mess, and it kind of can be at times. However, you can do the same thing with English. You'll find if you take all the vowels out, and you can really still make sense of a passage if you know the language well. Now, when there are no vowel markers in Hebrew, the word Edom and the word Adam, they have the same consonants. Right? It's just the vowels that distinguish between the words. So what the author does is he moves from the particular Edom to the general, Adam, as in mankind. He says, not just you, Edom, everybody, all these nations are going to have the day of the Lord to deal with. All nations. America too. You know, I visited a friend of mine this past week, and he said something that I thought was just so spot on. He said, God is directing human history like a human author directs characters in a story, including plot devices. Historical events look like foreshadowing because it is foreshadowing. Now, when we read about the day of the Lord, what the author is talking about is a day of reckoning. It is a day of accountability when accounts are settled with God. Okay? Now, there are many days of the Lord, many days of reckoning, many days of accountability, but there is also a final, great day of the Lord, a final day of accountability. So these many days of the Lord, these events are foreshadowing this coming great day of the Lord. Now, in the text here, Judah is experiencing a day of the Lord. And the Lord is telling Edom, don't laugh, because your day of the Lord is coming. In fact, one of the consolations, we covered Lamentations already, but one of the things the author says there to console the people, listen to this, he says, this is Lamentations 4, verse 21 and 22, don't turn there, he just says, rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, who dwells in the land of Uz, because the cup will come around to you too. You will become drunk and make yourself naked. The punishment of your iniquity has been completed, O daughter of Zion. He will exile you no longer, but he will punish your iniquity, O daughter of Edom. He will expose your sins. It says, laugh it up. I hope you're enjoying it. Our day is already done. We're experiencing it. Yours is yet future. Be careful. Can an individual experience a day of the Lord? You better believe it. I came to know the Lord through a personal experience with a day of the Lord in my life. He broke me down. Thought that I was high on the hog. He says, I can bring you down. And he did. And that's how I came to know him. Can a church experience a day of the Lord? Just read Revelation 2 and 3. A church can experience a day of the Lord. Stanger Springs can experience, as a church body, a day of the Lord. Lord says to those churches in Revelation 2 and 3, you better straighten up or I'm coming and I'm going to remove your lampstand. I'm going to close the doors. We're going to pack up shop because I don't need you to accomplish my purposes in the world. You can either be on my team or not. That's up to you. But I'm going to accomplish this thing. So get on board or get out. carry on. Look at it in verse 15, the second half. As you have done, it will be done to you. That is, in this day of the Lord. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head. Because just as you drank on my holy mountain, all the nations will drink continually. They will drink and swallow and become as if they never existed. Now, we've all heard of the golden rule, right? Treat others as you want them to treat you. Well, I wonder where that comes from. What we have here is more like the iron rule. Your dealings will return on your own head. Okay? I think of Paul in Galatians 6. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For as you sow, so shall you reap. Not something like it. The very thing. The very thing that you sow, you will reap. It's a very interesting thing about God. He loves irony. Talk about Edom, right? Esau's name red because of red lentil soup everywhere his people live. It's all red. I think of Pharaoh wants to drown all the little Israelite babies so that they can't field an army. By the end of the story, the Lord takes Pharaoh's army and drowns them. Think of Paul, a believer who enters the story holding the robes of the people who are going to stone Stephen. And then a little bit later in the story, now Paul's a believer. And he's the one getting stoned. God loves irony. Okay? And he's not mocked. You make your bed, you lay in the bed. And that's the situation here. Now, you know what I find very interesting about this book, the book of Obadiah? We don't really know if Edom ever got this message. I mean, we didn't find this oracle in the Edomite Bible. We find it in the Hebrew Bible. Why is it here? You know, why are the Jews including this in their book? What hope does it give to the exiles that the author is speaking to? Look at the end. Just listen to it. Verses 18 through 21. Well, I'll start at 17. Okay. The nations are going to become as if they never existed on the great day that's coming. But on Mount Zion, there will be those who escape, and it will be holy. And the house of Jacob will possess their possessions. And the house of Jacob will be a fire. And the house of Joseph a flame. But the house of Esau as stubble. And they will set them on fire and consume them. So that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau. For the Lord has spoken. Then those of the Negev will possess the mountain of Esau. And those of the Shephelah the Philistine plain. And also possess the territories of Ephraim and the territory of Samaria. And Benjamin will possess Gilead and the exiles of this host of the sons of Israel, who are among the Canaanites as far as Zarephath. And the exiles of Jerusalem, who are in the Shepherd, will possess the cities of the Negev. The deliverers will ascend Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau. And the kingdom will be the Lord's. He's telling the exiles here, look, the exiles of Israel, the northern kingdom, you got the guys that got taken away by Samaria, yeah, I bet you thought that was hilarious. Those guys, and the exiles of Jerusalem, the southern kingdom, Judah, which was taken away by Babylon, they're coming back. These guys are coming back. This host. How? Resurrection. They're going to possess the land. Look at it. Even the tribal allotments. Verse 19. Benjamin's possessing Gilead. Now we have a tribe popping up in that land that was promised. They're still going to get that. Okay. That birthright that you despised, it's still in play. God doesn't renege on those gifts. The gifts and the promises of God in this instance are irrevocable. If God promises it, if He makes a covenant, it'll happen. They'll return, they'll possess, they'll judge, and God will reign from His kingdom on earth. So laugh at that. Now I look at this and I ask, what can we learn about God from the book of Obadiah? What can I learn about His character from this book? We know that God is sovereign. And of course that's You know, he's the boss. He's running things. Everybody ultimately answers to him. That's true, and that definitely comes out in this book. But I think of equal importance is the fact that God is not an absent parent. He's not an absent parent. He sees. He sees, he remembers, and he will hold the nations accountable. They may look like in the now time that they're getting by with it, but they're not getting by with it. Okay? Because evil is not swiftly punished. It's in the heart of men to do all kinds of evil. Okay? Because the judgment isn't quickly passed, they think judgment's never going to come. He says, it's coming. God didn't miss a thing. Secondly, we see what God hates in a national sense, but in a character sense. The author of Proverbs in Proverbs 16 says, look, there are six things the Lord hates, even seven. But you know what number one is? Pride. Haughty eyes. He hates it. Absolutely hates it. He says, I don't care if you are an individual or a nation or an angel from heaven. If you are proud, I'm going to bring you down. It was the sin of Adam. It's the sin of Edom. It was the sin of Satan. And interestingly, you'll see the same language. You want to go look at other oracles against nations that are proud? You want to go look at the oracle against Satan? You know, I will lift myself above the stars. They're saying the same thing that Edom's saying. He says, I'm going to bring you down. I'm going to bring you down.